It's an exhibit.
And we're back. The Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. You can, and if you want to find our previous programs, that's at taylor-report.com. I have had some inquiries. There was a small glitch. We're about 2 weeks behind, but I'm told now that it's going to be brought up to date. So I really appreciate the fact that people are interested and care about that. And so once again, write taylor@ciut.fm. I have to say, I saw the film Lincoln. I'm going to be trying to get a Lincoln authority on the show. I'm not one, but I do pay attention. There used to be a kind of a thing. There's a lot of snobbery in the Lincoln circles, and I remember Gore Vidal Edmund Wilson once said about Carl Sandburg. Sandburg was a lovely man, a great poet, and he was a Lincoln idolater. And he said the worst thing to happen to Abraham Lincoln after being shot at Ford Theater was to fall into the hands of Carl Sandburg. I'd say that something like that has happened with Mr. Spielberg. Daniel Day-Lewis tries to play a monument, and to make a monument move around is kind of awkward. And there is a great moment, a great actor in the film who was permitted to play a human being, and that's Tommy Lee Jones, and he plays Thaddeus Stevens, who he plays him in a vivid way, completely memorable. And by the way, Thaddeus Stevens was an abolitionist, so he makes a lot more sense than Lincoln, who was not an abolitionist, and therefore was often saying things which were a little obscure to follow. I think folks need to know. But there's also a shocking moment in the film, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that it has to be false. There was a lot of things it bothers me that historians like Doris Kearns, can't say her name now, but anyway, Goodwin, who wrote this book, the last major publication about Lincoln called Cabinet of Rivals or something, Team of Rivals. Her name's on this film. And there's another gentleman named Holzer. And, you know, they get a lot out of this. I mean, their names are big. If you leave the theater, you bump into a stack of books and by her. And I think we see Hollywood versus academia in the worst possible way, because she points at the book and says, I'm proud of this book. And on the cover of the book is Daniel Day-Lewis, not Abraham Lincoln, but the guy who played him in a movie, is now on the cover of her book. When it was published, that wasn't the cover. So now it has a new cover, and on the cover is a movie actor looking like Abraham Lincoln. I think that's called prostitution in some circles. But anyway, I want you to know I'm not terribly taken with the film. I think we're joined now by Zafar Benkash. There, Zafar.
Hello, Phil. Yes, I am with you.
I hope you enjoyed the movie review. I'm sorry, but I took a little.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, good. Now, Zafar, you are the best authority that any of us know when it comes to what's going on at the moment in places like Syria, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, all of whom seem to be engaged. And this morning, we're told, Israel's fired shells, a tank fired, proudly said they had a direct hit on a Syrian target, which would be a military target.
That's correct, yes.
And so this is not funny at all anymore. This is getting really dangerous.
Yes.
And we, of course, had the weekend meeting.
Yes.
I guess let's start with that one. Hillary assembled these people and told them, you're going to stay in this room until we have our team of rivals, I guess.
Absolutely.
And she got, I guess, what she wanted. Who are these people, and what do you think their prospects are?
Well, to start off with, the new person that has been appointed head of the new opposition, they keep on coming up with these three-letter oppositions that they keep on, you know, creating. There was this Syrian National Council, and now they have renamed it the Syrian National Initiative. And the new head of this group is a person by the name of Mawz al-Khatib, who actually used to be the imam at the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus. And he fled from Syria to Turkey in July. And he has now been made the head of this new organization that also incorporates the Syrian National Council. But as you mentioned, these people were there for more than a week. In fact, they started the Saturday before, and from that time until yesterday, they were forced to stay there, and the Syrian National Council tried to wriggle its way to try to maintain its leadership role by insisting that, no, they were the ones that have been representing the Syrian people, and they can do so even now. And they elected a new leader, the third in less than in about a year's time. But I think the Americans were absolutely determined to put them aside because they have been found completely wanting. And the reason why they have been found wanting is because these people have absolutely no credibility, no standing inside Syria. I mean, these are all armchair academics that have spent their life in Paris or other places, and all of a sudden they thought that just because they have Western support that they are going to be successful inside Syria as well. I mean, their thinking was that the government of Bashar al-Assad would collapse within a few months, just as Muammar Gaddafi's government collapsed in Libya, and so these people were thinking that now they are going to ride these tanks into Damascus and take over. But when they found that Bashar al-Assad's government is not as weak as they thought, and also that he still has considerable support inside the country, and most importantly, the various institutions of state have not disintegrated, neither the military nor the bureaucracy, the establishment, the government, etc., by and large, it has remained intact. And so, and also that he proved far more resilient than anybody had predicted. So in that sense, the Syrian National Council, although it went through various leadership changes, and yet ultimately the Americans thought that, well, we have given them enough time, we have given them enough opportunity, but they have not proved up to the task. So now they've chosen somebody who was in Syria until last July. So they think that, you know, that would give this new leader, Mawz al-Khatib, more credibility. But quite honestly, I do not think that the Syrian opposition has much of a chance, because, you know, the real problem is that most of these people do not have any support inside Syria. That's the first point. And secondly, inside Syria, there is enough evidence to indicate that the overwhelming majority of the rebels are not Syrians at all. So no matter what face or what individual they put forward as the leader of this council or that council or this Syrian national organization or whatever, it will not carry much weight inside Syria at all, because the people that are involved, not so much in the fighting, I would say they are involved in acts of terrorism. Because, you know, we have seen enough footage. I mean, it should be obvious to even the most naive that these people are absolutely ruthless murderers. There is footage on television. They have murdered Syrian soldiers that had already surrendered. They were unarmed. They were lying on the ground. And 30 of them were shot dead. Video footage is available. They did it in front of Reuters cameras, etc. And then 2 days ago, we saw other footage in which civilians were dragged out of their homes, and these thugs and mass murderers shot them in the streets. I mean, this is all footage available on the internet if one wants to see it. And these definitely would constitute war crimes.
Yes.
So these pugs,
something that we're not hearing from the ICC.
Exactly. We're not going to hear from them. Exactly. They're not even interested in sort of talking about it. And yet here is evidence available on the internet, on YouTube, and one can go and see it, that these people are killing civilians. Mm-hmm. These are unarmed civilians. Their hands are tied behind their backs. They drag them out and they shoot them in the head.
Yes.
And, you know, these are the kinds of mass murderers that are masquerading as so-called freedom fighters in Syria. And the U.S. and Qatar and Saudi Arabia and all of these regimes are backing them, you know.
Well, on that point, I mean, incidentally, they are true terrorists in the sense that also the tactics they use, this thing of sending automobiles with their captives in them, directing them into roadblocks to blow them up. Things of that kind. And then I saw the New York Times had a photograph. It was a still, of course, of a young man cowering and men pointing weapons at him. Of course, later I saw that on YouTube. They went ahead and shot him. The New York Times didn't share that.
Yes.
They allowed us to see him cowering, but then they murdered him. And they also they are terrorists in the sense that, yes, they want you to see them terrorizing.
Yes.
In other words, they want that camera there.
This is
their type of propaganda, yet no one in the West wants to use this word to describe them. But they're terrorists, for sure.
Absolutely. Like, you know, you mentioned these car bombings. These are now becoming so routine inside Syria, in Damascus, in other places. And obviously, car bombs are not directed specifically at military targets, even if they, you know, are blown up in military areas, etc., because there are civilians around. So each time there is a car bombing, and it is incidentally a signature mark of Al-Qaeda, that's the terrorist outfit that carries out these kinds of things. And here we have a situation in Syria whereby the U.S., which has been telling the world for the last 10, 12 years that it's fighting Al-Qaeda, and yet it's deeply involved in Al-Qaeda in Syria. The Saudis are financing it, the Qataris are financing it, and these are not regimes that the U.S. is about to declare as state sponsors of terrorism.
Mm-hmm.
And we see this kind of hypocrisy that pervades this entire discourse about Syria. So you have on the one hand the Americans and their Arab allies trying to cobble together another opposition group so that it might have a little bit more credibility. But it does not have any credibility. These are not people that command any respect inside Syria. And secondly, the people that are doing the fighting and the terrorizing in Syria are, for the large part, outsiders. They've either come from places like Iraq, where they were operational, where they were carrying out these car bombings, etc., or from Saudi Arabia or to Tunisia or Algeria or Egypt or even Turkey and as far afield as Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Chechnya. Mm-hmm. So you have a whole group of mercenaries that are operating inside Syria.
Yes,
to bring down the government.
They're being transported and paid well.
Yes,
it would appear that Hillary's policy is they just keep pumping these individuals in, so that they can have havoc. I get the impression that they understand now they may be in a longer fight, but they intend to just keep having things go off.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to go into Damascus with armed force. Just set a couple bombs off.
That's correct.
And you can say, oh, look at that. You see the instability in the country.
Yes.
It may cost you four or five mercenaries, but that's not very expensive from a U.S. point of view. We're speaking to Zafar Ben-Gash, crescent-online.net. Am I right?
That's correct, yes.
A wonderful site that people ought to use. Today's news also brings us the announcement that the six Gulf states, the GCC, have recognized this Clinton concoction as sole legitimate representative of the Syrian people.
Right.
Could you remind us who the six wonderful sponsors of democracy are?
Yes, exactly. That's a very good question. Well, you know, they have such great democracies like Saudi Arabia and Qatar and United Arab Emirates and Bahrain and Kuwait and Oman. And you would notice, with the exception of Kuwait, none of these other countries have ever held elections. And even in Kuwait, to complete the picture, a parliament that was elected through fair elections, free elections, in which the opposition had a majority in parliament, then the Emir of Kuwait had that dissolved. And although the opposition members went to court and had the parliament restored, and yet the Emir still dismissed the parliament. And right now, as we speak, there are in fact protests taking place in Kuwait. It's amazing, actually. Tens of thousands of people have come out into the streets. They are demanding the restoration of that parliament, and they are opposed to the electoral laws that the Emir wants to implement on his own, because these members of parliament know what this game is all about. They are saying that these changes that are being made, they would be done in such a way that they would benefit those members that are backed by the government of Kuwait, and so any independence that these members have would be severely curtailed. Mm-hmm. So there have been actually protests going on for more than a week to 10 days now in Kuwait. Yesterday also there were about tens of thousands of people in the main square outside the parliament building. And of course they were very peaceful, although the police and the military was out in strength, but the protesters were completely peaceful. But they said that we will not accept these unilateral changes to electoral law that the government is trying to implement, that if any changes are to be made, they should be brought before the parliament and let the parliament decide, because the parliament is the representative of the people. Whereas the Emir, the Sabah family, they have ruled Kuwait for 250 years, but they were never elected by anybody. I mean, Kuwait itself is a British creation. Yeah. It was carved out of Iraq back in the early 1920s.
Yeah. Doesn't the word name mean fort?
That's correct, yes.
It was a British fort.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so you see that the Gulf Cooperation Council members, when it was established back in 1981, we had dubbed it the Gulf Conspiracy Council, because these guys, there is not a cooperation council. It's of course dominated by Saudi Arabia, and we all know exactly what kind of a great model of democracy Saudi Arabia is. Mm. When the king dies, then according to their constitution, the next brother in line takes over.
The brother in line.
That's right. And now that's their model of democracy. And now they're even running out of brothers, because...
Not the brother-in-law, the brother-in-line.
Yeah, so, some of the brothers are sort of, dying before the king himself. Two of them have died recently. And so that has really put the poor king in a big dilemma, because he himself is about 89, 90 years old, and there's a team of doctors and nurses hovering over him all the time, as if they are going to stop him from dying. I don't know what he thinks this has happened with a 90-year-old man.
Just look at a calendar, and he might
make certain
predictions.
Exactly. I mean, his shelf life has expired, so I think he ought to be thinking of the next world rather than worrying about this one so much.
He probably doesn't really want to think about that. This is Zafar Bengash. It's crescent-online.net. And Zafar, something interesting has happened here, and it's related somewhat to this crisis in Syria. Some are linking it. The head of the CIA has fallen through a trap door of his own devising. And because of all the talk about the personalities involved, there are little video clips of various individuals popping up, including his biographer and apparently the woman he was involved with, Miss Broadwell.
Yeah.
And she was lecturing at University of Colorado Denver, I think. And she said about the Benghazi events, and now everybody's realizing that she was had a lot of inside information.
Yes.
And she said, well, you know, the general had a lot of problems with this because he wasn't allowed to speak to the press. But she said a factor that isn't widely known is that the CIA was holding some Libyan militiamen at their quarters there. And that the attackers were trying to free the militiamen.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, gee.
That's the very...
Why haven't they talked about this more?
Right.
Because now we're back to, you know, taking... And, of course, Obama told us he wasn't doing that. Oh, everybody understands he is, but she actually said it.
Yes.
Now, this is all before her relations were known. Everybody understood she was somehow close to him.
Right.
But I found that very striking information. I hadn't heard that they had... in that compound there, they had a CIA office apparently,
right.
And then they had what they, I guess, called the consulate.
Yes.
I don't blame the attackers for being a little confused, like
yes.
Which house is which? Oh, that's a consulate over there. We're keeping the prisoners over here.
Right, right. Yeah, but you know, you raise a very interesting point. I had personally not come across this piece of information about Paula Broadwell talking about. Some Libyans being held by the CIA, and as you said, of course, you know, this is something that I think people ought to know, that in many of these U.S. Missions abroad, whether it is in Benghazi or in Cairo or in Pakistan, the CIA is deeply involved in these missions. In fact, they have in the case of Pakistan, I can tell you for sure. That the CIA has more personnel in that embassy than it has diplomatic staff.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these CIA personnel come as either businessmen or consultants, or they take all of these...
Or phantom individuals. We interviewed you on this program maybe a year ago, perhaps longer, when a CIA man... shot dead two Pakistani policemen.
Exactly. Exactly.
He murdered him. He got out of his car and killed him.
That's right. He shot two Pakistanis in broad daylight.
And he got caught by the police, and they released him
exactly.
And let him go home.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. So.
And by the way, isn't that very similar to what just happened? If what she said is true, there was a case of CIA people. They had taken Libyans and were holding them in a U.S. illegally, obviously,
right.
In U.S. facility, which they were going to deny the existence of. We don't know what they were doing with them.
Right.
But when Libyans acted against that, and we don't even know who, I mean, they're not telling us that, oh, we're going to have a CIA office there, and they're going to take Libyans off the street.
Yeah.
I mean...
exactly. This is the kind of thing that, you know, unfortunately, this information is not divulged. And even when people talk about it and bring it out, the not only the American government, but regrettably even their media is very dismissive of these kinds of reports. They either rubbish them by saying that these are all conspiracy theories, etc., mm-hmm. or they just flatly deny that any such thing is happening.
Yeah, and the issue becomes, oh, what about those poor guys who were holding the poor Libyans prisoner?
Yeah.
You know, the only guy who matters is the white guy.
Right. Yeah.
But how about the Libyan who, we don't, on what authority did they capture them?
Yes,
and
exactly.
And were they, what did they do with them? Because their track record, Abu Ghraib, is somewhat shocking.
Absolutely.
Which, by the way, I think we all agree that was probably just the tip of an iceberg,
right.
Abu Ghraib.
Right.
That wasn't, you know, the vast ugliness of it. That was just a glimpse.
Yes, because you know, even at that time when the Abu Ghraib information came out, the terrible photos, the Defense Department and the CIA, etc., tried desperately hard to withhold other photographs, and in fact, some of the senators and congressmen had said that if all of the photos are released. They are more horrifying than mm-hmm. what has been released to the
yes,
public.
Yes, and it was Obama who blocked that.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and Bush, they wouldn't have allowed it. If Bush was still in office, the Democrats would be screaming, you've got to show us the pictures.
That's
now
right.
That they have Obama, see, nobody wants to see the pictures.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're considered a bad person you know, a Roseanne Barr or something if you bring it up.
Yes.
Well, anyway, luckily for us, Petraeus had girlfriends. There's a...
I don't think
we've got to the bottom of this. But my favorite, I want to know if you noticed this, is that one of the ways he got caught in this problem was that a photograph was released of him at his headquarters, his main office, super secure, with Angelina Jolie,
yes,
who
exactly.
we often hear from out telling Syria that Assad has to be overthrown, or she says that Zimbabwe has to, the government has, everybody has to do what she says, and when she's out in the field as a UN person.
Right.
But she apparently was in the office with Petraeus, had her picture taken with him.
Right.
The way it became a problem was that there is only official photographers allowed in those quarters. So someone said, well, did you take that picture? And the guy said, no.
No, I didn't do that.
Well, then who took the picture?
Right.
And that led them back to somebody interesting.
That's correct, yes.
It's a very curious group of people.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you know, you're right. What would Angelina Jolie be doing in the CIA chief's office when, in fact, she's representing...
Yes.
The UN, not
yes.
the CIA. I mean, you know, this raises other interesting
questions. Well, of course it does. It just seems to be... there is a wonderful website called Mondowees in New York.
Right.
I forget it. His name's Philip Mondowees. That's Philip Weiss, not Mondowees.
Right.
He said this is not the first time that the CIA chief had a problem. He got attacked by Sarah Palin about a year or so ago, and so he wrote... Apparently, on his own email, he wrote to a right-wing blogger or an expert and said, how do I get out of this? And the guy said, well, I think I can handle this, because he looked like he might be criticizing Israel and he didn't want to get in any trouble. So the guy advised him. So then Petraeus wrote back to his advisor and said, oh, by the way, I had Elie Wiesel and his wife were at my office recently. Would it be good to mention that? And the guy said, no, no, you don't have to say that, because they haven't accused you of anti-Semitism, so don't mention that. I agree. The Toronto Star today has writers saying they should keep this wonderful guy. I agree. This has been great. I don't want us to be without Petraeus. He seems to be stupid and clumsy. That's exactly what we're looking for if you're a talent scout. Zafar, I want to ask you one. This is Zafar Bengash, crescent-online.net. A Nobel Prize winner in Myanmar has said that the Muslims there who are being persecuted and driven into camps and having their villages burned, she can't do anything to help them.
Right. Not only that. I mean,
what do you make of that?
You know, Aung San Suu Kyi, who's a poster girl for much of the Western world, I mean, of the official world, that, you know, she's a human rights campaigner and she spent so much time under house arrest, et cetera, et cetera. She even denies that these people are Myanmar citizens. She says that, you know, these are infiltrators into Myanmar and that they should be taken care of somewhere else. So they should not be...
But they've been there for hundreds of years, haven't they?
For centuries, even like it goes as far back as something like the 8th century or something. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure how far does one have to go in order to be able to consider...
Well, she learned all this at Oxford, I think.
Yeah, probably, you see. So she, like, you know, apart from, far from being the human rights campaigner, she's actually denying the very existence of these people. Yeah. I mean, it's shocking beyond belief that a person like her, for whom the whole world was campaigning to get her, you know, house arrest restrictions removed, and that she should be allowed to participate in the political process. And here she is saying that, you know, these people are not citizens of Myanmar, and therefore they should be thrown out.
Yeah.
And her country's president had even said to the UN that you should set up a refugee camp somewhere else and just take them away. I mean, you know, this is the incredible situation that we are confronting
with. And by the way, this case is being brought by some countries to the Security Council, aren't they?
Yes. Yes.
Because obviously, why can't she simply say, make them citizens? Wouldn't that be the humane thing? We talk about this in the United States. They have this issue of Mexican-Americans.
Yes.
If they have, well, then just, you know, give them status and get it over with.
Right.
Otherwise, people will be harmed.
Exactly. Exactly. But unfortunately, you see, these kinds of things are not being talked about because Myanmar has just opened up and there are a lot of natural resources and everybody wants to get their hands on those resources. So, what are a few tens of thousands of poor Muslims? They are disposable commodities,
so they
don't care about them.
So next week she will host her fellow Nobel Prize winner Obama when he comes to Myanmar.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Well, Zafar Bengash has been very enlightening. Crescent-online.net. I hope everybody goes to that site. Thank you very, very much.
It's my great pleasure, Phil. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There you are. As advertised, Zafar Bengash. He is always on top of all the information. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. We have a website, taylor-report.com. And Phil, I thought you were going to say something, I think. No? He's shaking his head.
No. Well, I'd like to say something about Aung San Suu Kyi because, you know, she was, I believe she's a British citizen, right, which is an interesting issue that nobody wants to talk about. I mean, she lived most of her life in Britain. She was married to a professor in Britain. She has British children who live in Britain. And then when it becomes convenient, all of a sudden she's, you know, back in the land of her birth as this national hero. And yeah. It's kind of phony.
Yeah. Well, it's business that we're going to make this a theme here, this thing of giving people prizes in order to give them a kind of gravitas on an international stage. And then they become sounding boards for reactionary ideas, including the president of Liberia, who is apparently now very much a minority status in terms of population because she's backing big corporations and the World Bank. But everybody said, well, she won the Nobel Prize. Well, that's a way to trump everybody else. So it's unfortunate. In the moments remaining, I'll tell you one thing about I was start off on this Lincoln film. I want to be sure I say, you know, if there's one thing I've known about the guy that people find interesting is that he was a very patient individual. There's a consensus about how he raised his children. Many people didn't like the way he raised them because he was not a disciplinarian. He didn't practice corporal punishment, and the neighbors complained that the Lincoln kids ran all over Springfield and did anything they wanted, and they couldn't get Abe to beat them up. He carried that through his life. And also, he had a wife who had many troubles. She had a lot of problems and suffered from hysteria, bouts of hysteria because of the death of her son in the White House, and had other difficulties. And everybody always said that Lincoln was extremely, he handled that situation well, and et cetera. So in the middle of the film, he slaps his son. And I'm telling Spielberg that did not happen. He has a full-grown son who wants to be in the army, and the son insults him, and so Lincoln, during the quarrel, slaps him. And I got to say, that's stop the press's news, because that is, in fact, not... But when something like that happens in a film, they assure you that the historians have vetted it. So if somebody didn't vet that, that's ridiculous. I understand that's not historically the most important, but when you're dealing with the character... And in a way, that's how Daniel Day-Lewis was supposed to be playing. He wanted to convey the real guy. Well, the real guy didn't do that. Instead, he had a reputation of being someone who would not have done it. So I'm curious how they let that matter pass. Anyhow, we will get back to these matters of the... We will try to have a Lincoln scholar next week. We used to talk to the gentleman who wrote the great book on the assassination, wrote a title of his book. I can remember the title. I'm having trouble with his name at the moment, but the title was His Name is Still Mud, which is it explaining how the conspiracy against Lincoln operated. You've been listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT 89.5 FM. And you can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. I want to thank Phil and Carol, and we'll see you next week.